Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everybody, and thanks for joining in for another exciting event of Talk with Tenny. The new tagline is, you don't have to be mad to call in, but it helps. We're in the process of a major shifts in our cultural environment as to how we're going to deal with the ills of society. And today I was informed of several more deaths of people involved with state-sponsored psychiatry. One that is the most horrifying to me is Michael Blair's murder. I actually spoke with somebody. Their public information person won't be available until Tuesday, the Fort Bend County Police. But I did speak with somebody who has made assertions that that it was a justified shooting. And so I'm a little concerned about this because we're living in a world of where a family member calls a hospital for somebody, and the hospital tells them to call 911, and the police arrive with somebody who was trying to injure himself, and within 5 minutes kill him. And so I'm not sure how this is justified or that this is any kind of justified response. When I asked if they had any kind of crisis intervention training for officers, I was informed that that person didn't know, and that was a question for the chief. So I will be following up on that and looking in. It's my understanding that someone in the Blair family, when they called the police because of a distrust in the police, had set up a camera, and so the entire thing is caught on video, and you can see this at YouTube, and the name of the video is Michael Blair Shot by Police in Fort Bend County, Texas, graphic. And I'd like to, anybody who goes and looks at that, I'd like to say that it is quite graphic. I have two callers, so I'm going to bring you both in at the same time and find out. Hi, we have one more caller. So area code 540, who's calling?
This is Dee Jacobson.
Hi, Dee. Thanks for calling in. And area code 917?
That's me. That's Haya. Hi, Grisberg.
Hi, Kaya. Hi, Dee. Great. Thanks, ladies, for coming on. How are you doing?
Good.
Good. So we're on air, and I'm just talking. I don't know if you were able to hear, but I was just talking about the murder of Michael Blair by the police during a call by the family after the family was told by the hospital to call the police. And 11 shots were fired, and he was standing in his bathtub. And I just feel like something else could have been done outside. And they tasered him first. And I just feel like something else could have been done. This happened in November, but apparently the family or somebody has put out the video, and it's very, very disturbing. And I think it gets to the issues that both of you had discussed with me about maybe talking about around both multi-generational trauma and this idea of the two options of what the law allows people to do. So I'm not sure, Kaya, if you would, do you want to introduce yourself and maybe give a little background as to what your concerns are? And then Dee, if you would do the same after?
Sure. Well, it's great to be on your show, and I have some history, personal history, of being almost forced committed, almost forced involuntarily drugged, and definitely have been forced committed. So this is definitely a topic that's near and dear to my heart, and even just the topic of, you know, somebody having cops come into their environment and, you know, be violent with them. Like, obviously I've never been shot by cops, or killed, that is. But, or shot, but But, you know, I have had police come to my home, handcuff me, and bring me to a hospital when I wasn't a danger to myself or others. And, you know, we're seeing this happening more and more, situations where cops are violent and where cops are being called for reasons that they shouldn't be called, perhaps, or, you know, we need to have better supports in our society for people in distress that we can call before calling police is what I feel. But I can say more about myself. I'll just give Dee a chance to introduce herself. I'll say more later.
Great. Thanks. Dee?
Yeah, this is an issue that's really near and dear to my heart. I apologize. Not only because of the situations with people who are in distress, categorized as somebody with a mental illness. Some people have a formal diagnosis, some may not. But this particular incident is not an isolated incident. It's very concerning. Another area where it's occurring, where there's an excessive use of force, is also in and around immigration.
Yes.
So it's not just isolated people with mental illness. There is seems to be an increasing prevalence of an overusage of excessive force by officers of the law, whether they're a sheriff, a city police officer, contracted security staff. It's a big concern, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I do not believe that the statistics of death by cop, using that sort of just an umbrella definition, I don't think there's statistics that's tracked nationally. And I just wanted to ask if anybody else was aware of that. The other thing I wanted to sort of, sorry, let me introduce myself. So my name is Dee Jacobson, and I work with several national, international, nonprofit organizations specific to advocating for the rights of people with mental challenges, specifically people that also include people that are in distress that may not formally have a diagnosis, who are just marginalized because they express themselves in the world a little bit differently than what some people may categorize as within the quote-unquote norm.
Great. Well, thanks for calling in, and I think that this is clearly an issue, and I'd like to say that, you know, I've never had any kind of negative altercation with a police officer in my life, and I, you know, like but as a means of training for these kinds of incidences that continue to come up, and I'd also like to say that there's, you know, questions as to how we're seen as less than human, that we can be even, you know, tasered, which is a quick step over to being shot, clearly, when people are escalated in how the situation goes. If you watch the video, it's horrifying as to, with no, from the very beginning, with the exception of a small space of time, at no point were the officers not yelling. And so how to deal with training people in alternatives and in seeing us as human, I think is going to be an important factor. I want to just bring, Kaya, ask you if you would talk a little bit about the article that you wrote, but we do have another caller on the line. Area code 718. May not be wanting to talk right now. So, Kaya, would you talk a little bit about the article?
Sure, yeah. And I actually realized I didn't actually properly introduce myself, so maybe I should just do that first really quick.
Okay.
Which is that I personally was on a bunch of psychiatric drugs when I was 22, and most of them were forced onto me And since then, I've been teaching and coaching people who want to come off psychiatric drugs about alternatives and different ways of looking at their situation. So I started by working with the Freedom Center in Northampton, Massachusetts, and have done a lot of speaking, writing, and teaching, as well as coaching with individuals who want a different way of looking at their situation as opposed to maybe seeing themselves as a mental patient. So this article that I wrote called Two Choices Doctors Have for a Sane Person in a Mental Hospital was about how when I was 21, I was forced hospitalized. And I was definitely going through a sort of extreme state of consciousness, whatever we might want to call that. You know, I was having experiences that were maybe different from the average person, but they weren't dangerous to anyone else for sure. And it's questionable whether they were dangerous to me. I don't think they would have been dangerous to me if I had support. I think they were dangerous to me because I didn't have anyone who was willing to really listen to me and understand where I was coming from and be supportive. So because of that, I felt that I needed to isolate myself. But when I was at the hospital, an interesting thing happened, which was that the psychiatrists actually didn't think I needed to be forced drugged, but they didn't have any other options for me because I didn't have a place to go. I guess the only place that I had to go was my parents' house at that time, but my parents were scared of my situation, so that wasn't an option unless they offered it, and they had been the ones to choose to put me into the hospital. So it was interesting because I had conversations with different therapists and different psychiatrists at the hospital who all basically agreed with me that I actually didn't need to be on psychiatric drugs. But the only choices they had were to either force commit me into a state hospital or to put me on forced drugs, you know, forced psychiatric drugs, where I would have been legally mandated to take drugs, which is, you know, something that there are laws for in each state called involuntary outpatient commitment. And I was really lucky because at the last minute, my mom ended up getting kind of scared and picking me up because she didn't want either of those options for me. So, that's basically the gist of this article, which I wanted to talk about and answer questions or hear other people's comments on this issue of the lack of options that people actually have because of the laws in our psychiatric system.
I'm sorry those things happened to you, and I'm glad that you were able to escape it. That's when I read the article, I really felt for a lot of what you were going through. I had a different situation myself, but I really, you know, could see how easy that could happen but I never had somebody tell me that I didn't need to be drugged. So you're, I guess, in some ways lucky that you didn't have to go through all of that. But the idea that there's only these two options for people is a huge part of the problem, and the monopoly that the psychiatric industry has through billing purposes and things like that just adds to the problems. Dee, do you have anything to say about this, or do you want to jump in?
Sure. I live in a state where we call them temporary detainment orders. And in our state, a relative can call a community health center and say they have concerns over a relative and explain a scenario and describe their behaviors. And a police officer can show up and do an assessment, not a psychological assessment, but just sort of a pre-assessment. And if the person is agitated because two officers just showed up in their house, the officers may opt to go ahead and put them in handcuffs and then take them to a local assessment center. And they can be in the assessment center for a certain amount of time. And within 24 hours or, you know, it varies by state, it can be determined by the magistrate that person does need to go ahead and be put in inpatient against their will.
Right, yeah. Yeah, in New York we have the involuntary outpatient commitment law here is called, commonly called Kendra's Law, and it's the program assisted outpatient treatment is like that. They actually have forms online that like a family member or a spouse or a roommate can fill out to have you picked up. It's pretty, but for no crime done, right? I mean, no, for outside of not complying with some kind of supposed medical treatment.
Right. There's no crime, and there's no legal representation. The person being detained is not provided any means for having legal representation. It's outside of the law.
And the police officer doesn't have any kind of, you know, they're not a psychiatrist or a psychologist or anything, right?
That's correct.
So it's really, I think, you know, one of the reasons I kicked off this little venture here with the show is to get to the public about what's actually going on and for the public to realize how the state-sponsored systems are veiling this as some kind of benevolent act for these, you know, poor people, and how, A, we are these, you know, poor people, and so that society can start to hear from us in our own voices, and that they, anybody potentially is at risk for this type of thing, especially if there is an economic struggle, and for all of us, you know, living in this capitalistic society we're in, for the majority of us, there's that economic struggle, you know?
I think it's a really good point you make that really anyone, this could happen to anyone, you know? Anyone could have a sort of a meltdown or go through an extreme time in their life where, you know, where they're not quote-unquote functional or people are scared of them for whatever reason. It really can happen to anyone, and a lot of it has to do with who has the power in the situation at hand, you know, whether it's socioeconomic power or political power or whatever the power structure is, there can be always a case where, you know, somebody who has more clout than you or whose opinion is for whatever reason heard as more valid than yours, you could end up in a situation where somebody calls the cops because they're scared of you, of your behavior. Now, for a lot of people, they might think, oh, that will probably never happen to me, and people might be more on the side of wanting to protect themselves from the ideas of other people being crazy, but I think maybe it would be great to shift the conversation towards, like, possible solutions to this because, you know, there are a lot of alternative models that just aren't being funded and alternative types of medicine. There's, you know, respite houses, which there's one in Massachusetts, I know, that's a really great one with the Western Mass RLC. It's called AFIA. You know, and that probably houses just a few people at a time. So it's one of those things where the current system is just so expensive and not cost-effective, you know, what we're doing in hospitals and with psychiatric drugs. It's just the most outrageously expensive and ineffective form of caring for people.
It really is, and so and the taxpayer expenditures, it's literally billions of tax dollars a year that, like, the public needs to be aware of this, that there are billions of tax dollars being spent on this every single year.
And that's more and more expensive each year because people are not getting better in this system, so it's not solving any of the problems, and it's actually making things more expensive, and people are getting sicker from being on psychiatric drugs and being forced committed. So things like respite houses and alternative forms of health care that actually help people improve their health could actually not only lower the cost right now, but lower the cost exponentially each year as people actually start to improve their health and improve their sense of support systems and community. So there are definitely better ways that we could be approaching these things that would actually be fairly easy and low cost to implement, especially over the long term.
Absolutely, and not creating even more medical expenses also from diabetes, tardive dyskinesia, Ehlers-Danlos syndrome, metabolic syndrome, the list goes on and on, kidney, liver damage. And so the 25 to 30 year shortening of a population of people's lives who anybody can fall into on the subjective assessment of somebody else that very often isn't taking in cultural values or beliefs or, you know, any of these other, you know, major important deciding factors for how somebody is, and certainly economics, you know, so some of these alternatives. So, and I know Dee, they're talking about this idea of multi-generational abuse, or trauma, rather, of how it continues to fold in. Have you seen this in terms of what it's costing taxpayers and other alternatives that could be being done that would be more helpful in its place?
Yeah, I've been working with a variety of different groups, Native American Indians, Indigenous people in Canada, and working with trauma survivors of multi-generational early childhood abuse. And all of the scenarios, there's just this huge and sort of learned behavior of a power over model, but of with excessive force, whether the abuse is physical, psychological, emotional, but it can then get perpetuated and handed down generation to generation to generation. And in the case of Native American Indians, where a disproportionate number of children have been removed from a Native family, they are then placed in a foster care system that is not with Indigenous people. So there's also this rift of culture shock at a young age where you're actually forming your sense of who you are. So I'm working with those tribes, and they are teaching me how they're using, you know, sort of some original tribal tradition, ceremony, and they're bringing those things back in, and families are starting to thrive, and the moms are just really starting to redeclare who they are in their own culture. And it's exciting. It's like standing at the precipice of, you know, a reawakening of a whole nation.
It sounds like really powerful work. You used the term power over model.
Yeah, power over model, sort of a patriarchal system, rather than being sort of a balanced family relationship built on respect and dignity. In a power over model, there's typically a person or maybe two people where there's lots of power struggle and a sort of a forcing children or a spouse to conduct and be themselves in a particular way that psychologically harming.
Right. And I think this ongoing theme of this power as a major issue is definitely something that needs to have some light shined on it. And, you know, in a future show, Vanessa Jackson is going to be coming on to talk specifically about power. But it's running through everything that I'm hearing in both of the conversations that you're offering. And I think that we need to get to these underlying issues of how do you become liberated from this psychiatric oppression and the power that psychiatry has in a country and in the world, really. It's that this is a global movement to try to raise awareness and break down the fraud that's being perpetrated by psychiatry. Kaya, I'm wondering, you said you do coaching?
Yeah, with individuals.
Would you talk a little bit about what that's about and what it's like for you and what it's like for people that you're involved with? Well, maybe not for you know, not obviously you're not going to speak for them, but of what that process for you was like.
Yeah, sure. So I do coaching with people who are either coming off psychiatric drugs or who have come off recently or who want to come off at some point. And I think a big part of what I do is really affirming people's reality that they're more than a mental patient, that they're more than a mentally ill person, you know, if they at some point had that identity or even, you know, some people really have identified with that themselves. And I think that, you know, when people read my blogs or hear me speak, they have this sense that they'll be witnessed for who they actually are, which is something so undefinable that we all are. So my experience is that it's just amazing to see people really come to life, and you can see that if somebody's witnessed as just a person that doesn't need to be put into a category and that their suffering doesn't need to be diagnosed, then you start to actually get these amazing riches that are underneath all of that, you know, underneath the suffering and underneath the idea that, you know, if somebody is suffering, that they need to be given a label and a drug and, you know, a quote-unquote treatment plan. And another really cool thing that I've noticed is that almost everybody, actually I shouldn't say almost, absolutely everybody who I've worked with has amazing creative gifts and is like working on bringing them out into the world. So another problem that's coming about with psychiatrically drugging and committing all of these people, especially with drugging, because we're not even really doing that much commitment anymore in terms of hospitalization, but it still is there, but is that we're losing out on a lot of really important gifts in our society. So if we're going to drug people so that their creativity and their emotions are now numbed down and hampered, then we can't access the gifts of that person. So we're all really losing out when we do that. So, yeah, it's actually really amazing, though, to see the people that I work with begin to share their writing, share their performances, share their speaking with the world, because these people who are being told they're mentally ill sometimes have the most important stories and the most important things to say, and that's why it can be so challenging for people like this to, you know, conform to the world that we're living in, because the world we're living in is totally messed up, and people who have the hardest time with it are very often people who have the most to offer to heal this world. So I think that, you know, that's why I feel so passionately about people who are labeled mentally ill and about redefining how we see them and how we treat them. And I don't even like to think of it as a category of them or these people, because it's really all of us. You know, it's really a shadow side of our whole world.
It is, and you know, in this blog that the two choices doctors have for a sane person in a mental hospital, you know, you write about this idea of all of these different emotions and you know, anxieties and fears and excitement and smiles and love and all of this stuff. How do you get somebody who has the power to commit somebody because they're having some you know, struggle with their, you know, emotions or what's going on in their life or economic situations or, you know, whatever the thing may be facing a person who is now standing in front of somebody who has the power to commit them? How do you get that person with that power to understand that these are so basic human experiences and that they're not things that ought to be, you know, identified as, you know, diseases that have no evidence of existing?
I think that is a really good question, and one of the problems is that we can't always or really ever control anyone else's ideas or how they will do or see things, but I think that the best thing we really can do is for every single person to share their story, share their views, you know, blog about what you've experienced and how you define your own experiences. You know, I think we do have a lot of possibility now because, you know, with the internet and social media and blogs and the sort of decentralization of the media, we have a lot of possibility right now for shifting the common viewpoint because people have the ability to read and listen to all different kinds of media. You know, 10 or 20 years ago, we were all under the influence of corporate media only. So that's another thing I'm really passionate about is people, you know, sharing their story. And we're even starting to see doctors, psychiatrists, all kinds of medical professionals starting to wake up to the reality of what their profession is doing and how it's harming people. You know, I recently was at the Rethinking Psychiatry Symposium here in Portland, Oregon, this past weekend, and there was a Harvard-trained psychiatrist there. His name is James Gordon. He's a medical doctor. And he basically said, you know, what we all know, what most of us who've been through this know, is that there actually is no biological similarities between people who are diagnosed with the same mental illnesses. So there's no biology whatsoever that makes these people similar. And, you know, Thomas Insel of the National Institute of Mental Health also said that there are no biomarkers at all. You know, the DSM actually has no validity. That was his statement.
So we're starting to see
more and more experts, doctors, or, you know, we should say quote-unquote experts, because it's funny that, like, sometimes the doctors are the last people to realize what their own profession is doing to people. But we're starting to see even these people that have societal clout, that people will listen to them. You know, if you say a Harvard-trained psychiatrist, people will say, oh, well, if that person doesn't think psychiatry is valid, then how could it be, you know? So there's no real solid answer to your question of, like, how we can actually transform the viewpoints of someone in power, but I think the best we can do is to keep sharing our own stories, keep, you know, reading and encouraging people we know. You know, we can also give those people articles to read, you know, studies and so forth that they might be able to understand or that they might find valid in their own language, you know, like studies by doctors, studies by, or just, you know, articles by doctors and so forth. Because there are quite a few psychiatrists who themselves are realizing what's going on and actually would like to do something about it. Like this psychiatrist named James Gordon has created a whole system of how people can recover from quote-unquote depression without psychiatric drugs and without any form of psychiatric treatment.
There's
several TED Talks, and what I can do is I can send the links to those to you, and you can put them on your blog. But there's several TED Talks that are excellent that really support what you're seeing, Taya. There's one researcher that did some research in an indigenous people, and in the TED Talk, to make it just a key point, he went in to study depression within this indigenous peoples. And they didn't even know what that was. You know, they didn't know what that was. And so they then looked at how their lifestyle was, and then they came back to the States, and they created a program for people that had been diagnosed with major depression, chronic, where there was no treatment that was being effective for them. Then they had tried everything. And so they created this program where they gave them a healthy diet and gave them exercise, not like going to the gym, but like pairing them up with other people to do walks in the mall. And he said that the outcomes from that project shocked him. That's a wildest dream. So I'll send you that link. It's a really good one. And then there's Eleanor Longden and the Voices Network. It talks about, you know, through mutual support, people were able to live absolute thriving lives and don't necessarily have to have their voices stop. We don't have enough options available for people. There are not enough easily accessible, affordable
options. And everybody's different. And when you don't have enough options for people to be able to select and choose from, that where they feel safe and not made to feel bad.
Then everything
spirals down into crisis mode.
Right. And when we're in crisis mode, we get things like the murder of Michael Blair that happened in November, and the video was just released recently. It's shot dead in his bathroom. And so when we really start to look at why don't they want to make these cost effective shifts, Kaya, it almost starts to feel like they want people to be sick and to become sicker. Like one of the most disturbing things that I learned was that Eli Lilly, makers of Zyprexa, that causes diabetes, proven and shown to cause diabetes, one of the other major drugs that they sell is the diabetes pen to control diabetes. And so outside of, a really fabulous business plan, why are we allowing society and the profit margin to be dictating what's going on in people's everyday lives? I agree that I think by sharing our stories and people calling in and talking and wherever you are, not here, you're welcome, but just wherever you are, to be, breaking the silence about psychiatric oppression, I think is so utterly important. I do want to give the phone number just in case anybody's listening and wants to call in. It's area code 267-521-0167, area code 267-521-0167. Kaya, one of the other things that you had mentioned was that you you also work in helping people coming off these drugs.
Yeah, I offer that. Yes, and currently, for whatever reason, my clients happen to be people who aren't quite ready to come off of them yet. And it's a really important thing to talk about, because another issue that we have with psychiatric drugs isn't just the harm that they cause, but it's how difficult they are to withdraw from for many people.
Yeah.
A lot of people would really, really love to be free from psychiatric drugs, but have so much trouble withdrawing because I've actually read that withdrawing from benzos or neuroleptics is actually much harder than withdrawing from any street drugs, such as cocaine or heroin, or the hardest street drugs to withdraw from. This is a very serious matter, especially if we're talking about forcing people to take these drugs, forcing people to take drugs that aren't easy, that are, like, for some people, nearly impossible to get off of. That's, like, a serious, serious human rights violation. But yes, I do coach people who are coming off psychiatric drugs, and it is, a process that's individual for each person, and some people need to get other things in their life in place before they're ready to come off. I mean, I would never make that decision for anyone else. It's always up to an individual whether they're ready or when they're ready to come off. But I think it's important to keep, for those of us who have come off psychiatric drugs, which I have, I was personally on 7 different drugs and at the same time, and, they pretty much completely knocked me out. And it only took me about a year or two to come off of them all, but I was also 22 and had only been on them for a year or two. So, as we get older and have been on them longer, it can be a lot harder for most people.
Because I think that's one of the things people don't realize, that because it's a prescription and quote-unquote legal, that it's safe and effective and that it's an approved drug. And that it doesn't do this kind of damage. And then when you add issues, so even for people who are voluntarily taking it, these side effects, this rewiring of the brain, because now you, whether or not there was something biological going on before, and there is absolutely no proof that something biological was going on, once you've introduced drugs, you've now effectively changed the chemistry. And that becomes very difficult for people, even people who are voluntarily, like people who may want to take it for some period of time, which with informed consent, a difficult choice, but if that's somebody's choice to make, that's their choice to make. Like people should be able to do whatever drugs they want to do. But if there is, but if it's involuntary, and this human rights, what's that?
Can I chime in on that last thing that you just said about the it's people's choice?
Yeah.
I really want to speak to that because I'm 59 years old. I experienced a lot of trauma as a child. I lived in California where there was all kinds of alternatives, and I had a thriving life. I worked for IBM as a systems engineer. I mean, I really had a thriving life. I had three wonderful children. They're all grown now, and I moved out to Virginia. And all that I'd ever been through, I had never had any experience with psychiatric drugs. Part of why I moved out here is because I wanted to go into the field of social work, psychology, counseling. And so I was taking classes at Germana toward that endeavor. Shortly after 9/11, that experience and other things that had happened, a doctor recommended that I try a medication. I was told that, you know, that it's an as-per-need basis and you have to be careful because it can be addictive. And I started with that for panic attacks. And then I progressively got worse over 3 years. I progressively was put on more and more psychotropic medications. I started losing my memories of raising those three precious children. I couldn't do math anymore. I was a systems engineer and couldn't do math anymore. I've been off those drugs now for almost 4 complete years. It took me a year and a half to titrate down off of them and experienced withdrawal syndrome effects for a year after I had completely stopped taking all of them.
Wow.
Now, I was never forced to take any of those medications. But if somebody could have explained to me all the things that had happened to me, I clearly would have had a different choice. And the reason that I decided to get off all the medications was I started doing query searches in YouTube looking for people that were talking about this subject. And last summer, I finally spent a significant amount of time, and I found case after case after case, a male nurse, some people in United Kingdom, people all over the world that were video chronicling their experience of withdrawal off of psychotropic medications. They talked about brain zapping, walking in the mall with their mom, and then all of a sudden, it'll feel like somebody stuck an electric prod inside their head, and it would just go off. And that was in multiple YouTube videos of multiple people. None of them knew each other. And I didn't have that particular brain zapping experience, but I would have periods of just sobbing, breaking down in a fetal position and sobbing for no reason at all. For the first couple of weeks after I did the next step down on dosage. So I hear what's being said about the withdrawal of some of these psychotropic medications is more profound than street drugs. Having done both, once when I was a teenager, I left home early, and I, you know, was in that circle, and then comparing what I went through in my 50s, the latter was unimaginably worse. So I wanted to thank you for bringing that up.
I think it's so important that people understand how these things really happen, and it sounds like it was a really painful and rough experience for you, and that this is part of what equates to the torture that we experience, and that it's not just on the drugs, it's trying to get off the drugs as well. And people are just so fooled, or, you know, the society, the public, by the television commercials, and, you know, it's just beat into their heads that this is a biological thing and that these pills will solve it. But pills don't solve problems that are they just don't work. They're destroying us. If you're somebody, go ahead.
I was just going to say, you know, people are, I think, so I also used to work in a mental health hospital, inpatient. And, you know, we got so indoctrinated that you can't tell these patients all the bad stuff about these drugs, because then they won't take them, and they need to take them. So there's this whole paradigm around why you can't tell people the truth. And, you know, hindsight now, looking back, I'm like, oh, my gosh, you know, I can't work in a psychiatric hospital now because it's too triggering. You know, I witness people being, you know, people start to get escalated, and instead of being met in a way that can help them get de-escalated, they would get confronted, like, you know, aggressively confronted, and it would scare them more. And then the staff would make the call that they needed to pin the person down, you know, and they would physically, five people, get on top of this person, holding them down with their knees, while a doctor runs up and sticks a needle in their buttocks and gives them massive doses of chlorazine. Oh, that reminds me. Oh, I do want to share this. Okay, so I did say when I left home early, I was in Greensboro, North Carolina, and I landed a gig at a drug crisis intervention clinic. So that was when I was 17. I'm 59 now, do the math. And I loved the job, and we got trained, and we were, you know, if people had a bad, you know, LSD trip, we were trained on how to stay there with them and just kind of provide empathetic support, reassurance, calming effects. And even we would go into the hospital with them. And the director at the time was really trying to break this pattern where if somebody was having a bad LSD trip, the protocol in many of the hospitals was to shoot them up with chlorazine. The unfortunate thing was that then when the person woke up much later, the LSD was not in their system anymore. But when they'd wake up into that same state of mind because it's the last thing they remember. So the chlorazine was not a good intervention. And so, you know, we were brought in.
That's interesting.
That maybe a little Valium, you know, but mostly just talking to them was so much more effective. So now I'm looking all the way back when I was 17 years old doing that, you know, and working out in the field and working the conferences, you know, or the, working all the music festivals, you know, in around Greensboro because it's a college town, and, you know. So, it's almost like my whole life now has gone completely full circle.
Great. Yeah, that's wild. The, I read in, I think it was Timothy Leary's Politics of Ecstasy, and one of the things I remember being surprised by that the antidote to a bad trip was Ritalin, because it would speed the person up and snap them out of it, or whatever the Ritalin derivative was then. So that is an interesting, you know, psychiatry had a choice. The phenothiazines and Thorazine and LSD all came out within, you know, years of each other. And they were testing them both, and the CIA was testing them, and MKUltra and such. And psychiatry made a decision to go to drugs that would sedate us instead of drugs that would, you know, cause what they were showing as effectiveness for attaining a spiritual experience and you know, limiting problems of impotence and helping resolve issues related to alcohol and other drug addictions. So, you know, this choice that psychiatry made, I'm not sure it was the best of choices. And the idea of being supportive towards someone when in a crisis or having an extreme emotional state of any kind is not to, like, run in yelling and banging on doors and telling the person to drop the only, you know. So I'm just thinking again of the Michael Blair video that I can't get out of my head. It makes me so mad. It's horrifying. It's horrifying that who knows what was going on with this man, but he was obviously in some amount of crisis that his family felt was instructed by a hospital to call 911. And, you know, and it just boggles the mind as to how this could be seen as justified. And so how many people that we know about or don't know about, because who's actually keeping these numbers, right? Is there a national database on the amount of people, like you asked before, Dee? how do we get people to see what these alternatives are of looking at multi-generational trauma, of looking at ways of healing, like Kaya was mentioning before? We have another caller on, area code 562.
Yes, that's me. Oh, I
Hi.
Just, can you hear me?
I can hear you. Hi, who's calling?
Oh, my name is Tom Klute. I'm a coaching client of Haya, and I live in Vancouver, Washington.
Hi.
Hi.
You're live on the air. What do you want to talk about?
Well, I just came on board, so I need a little orientation on what your topic is, please.
Okay, well, we were talking about multiple things. One is a police shooting of somebody who had a psychiatric history while he was in a bathtub in his family's home, and how enraged I am by the idea that this, there's video of it, that this shooting is considered justified by the Fort Bend County Police. And then we were also talking about this idea, Dee Jacobson is on, talking about this idea of multi-generational trauma, and how particularly of concern to me is what's happening with the children of being taken away from their indigenous culture and being put in foster care, which has a whole series of issues. But how when one starts to embrace a culture and make room for one's culture, that an entire community can change. And Kaya was talking about the problem that there's only two choices for doctors, and neither are really a choice, either forced, you know, institutionalization or forced drugged in the community. And then some of the work that she does in alternatives and with coaching and helping people coming off drugs and being a support to them, and about alternatives that can be done which are cost-effective and wouldn't be wasting taxpayer dollars the way they are now with the system of human rights violations in the name of a fraudulent system of psychiatry. How's that?
And what was your name? Thank you so much. And what was your name, ma'am?
My name is Lauren.
Lauren Cheney. Okay, great. Thank you so much. I apologize for my lack of background, but I'm with you, I heard you, and then I do have a lot to say in response, so I want to be respectful. What's the time frame that would be respectful to talk and respond?
Well,
like 1 minute,
I think
2 minutes, or what?
We've all been in conversation. You're welcome to stay on for the remainder of the show and you know, join in the discussion, and we have an hour and 5 minutes left.
Okay, so did you want me to respond to that, or were you just giving me an orientation so I could listen in?
No. I'm just giving. I would love for you to respond and talk about whatever you'd like to talk about.
Okay, I'll try and keep it under 2 minutes. Does that sound good?
All right, and then.
All right,
I hope
you can
stay on
you
after.
Can stop me, or you can let me know if you want me to pause.
Okay,
so no
great.
Problem. Okay. So again, my name is Tom. I'm in Vancouver, Washington, and I am working with Kaya. and she's invited me to learn to practice getting my voice out there, and so she invited me to listen in. I would like to start my own blog radio, and I just wanted to bring my voice onto the planet instead of being in isolation geographically, go ahead and use the tools of the virtual community. So, okay, so Lauren, is it Lauren, right?
That's right.
Okay, so I'm trying to put a whole worldview into a few words, but I am grateful to have done enough homework within myself, and I've gone through a very powerful and excruciatingly wonderful spiritual emergence and things like that, including psychiatric support from the VA hospital and lots of other helpers and coaches and healers and on, and myself, of course.
Tom, are you a veteran?
I am, yeah.
Thank you for your service.
Oh, thank you.
Okay.
And you're welcome. So what I am wanting to share, Lauren, is that based on my observation and research that, and I'll give a couple of references for credibility, that would include the unified field theory that Dr. Nason is promoting. It's called the Resonance Project. Just Google that. And he has a wonderful training on what the unified field theory offers. It's very much in alignment with the integral theory, which completely heals our dualistic rift of fragmentation and separation, which our bodies are torn from our spirits on a subatomic level. So we come into a different, refreshing, innovative, and well, not innovative, but just an indigenous, really. So deep wisdom. I was reflecting on that note that our bodies really don't lie to us. Our bodies are tremendously wise, and I was reflecting that actually our bodies are very ancient. The cells and the subatomic particles, we're all wonderfully ancient. So we can tune into that wisdom. So anyway, I'm trying to get back to my share here, and that is that we're in a tremendous shift. And as the author, his name is Bruce Lipton, he's the author of, I'll think of it in a second, but Bruce Lipton, he's a evolutionary cell biologist, and he teaches that, the metaphor he uses is that if someone had been on a planet that had never seen a sunset, then they'd be pretty upset and overwhelmed and disillusioned when the sun went down, and or if winter happens. Because they wouldn't know that spring was on its way, and so
says
that the cycles of life, and this particular epoch that we're going through as a planet and a system and our species and everything, that yes, and oh by the way, and see Dr. What's his name, Deepak Chopra, beautiful quote. He says, "All great changes are preceded by chaos." So this is actually a good sign, and we are going to get. So basically the idea that we heard before that sometimes it gets worse before it gets better. And then finally one more reference which I listened to, I really love, from the Pleiades Fellowship of the Light. She was sharing that our human species has not yet really learned that love is the essential essence that makes everything work, and that we're still attached pretty strongly to greed and what was the other word she used? Greed and another basic, a lack of humility for sure, but I think violence. But anyway, so all that is in process, and so my final share here is that as I come into my own healing, then I create the toxins I've vomited up a lot of emotional, spiritual toxins, and so that's created much more spaciousness for me to be able to come into my own voice. And here's my final share. When we come into our own voice, then the game's over and we're moving forward. I really feel that in myself, and I feel that as well as a conviction. So I really, I think, and I'll just stop there. Thanks so much.
Well, Tom, I want to really thank you. You brought up a lot of really good points, and I think this idea of unified field theory is something that people should definitely be learning more about. And the way you express that of having your soul ripped from your body, the public needs to understand what is really going on and how it is we experience things instead of just shunning us away and locking us up and drugging us. And I want to say that if anybody hasn't heard about Paula Kaplan's book, When Jane and Johnny Come Marching Home, issues that our veterans are experiencing right now, and then obviously what's on the news about the waiting lists, the fake waiting lists that the VA has been putting forth, are such horrifying experiences for people who have gone out and defended our country coming back. And what is occurring with veterans all over the country is just horrifying to me and something that really needs to have some public attention put on it. I've had vets call and talk to me about how they're being forcibly drugged and in one particular situation, electroshocked. And so I think that people need to be aware and having their guns taken away from them, you know, as many people because of psychiatric profiling that we're all, you know, being up against this. And I think things, Tom, like what you're talking about of unified field theory and bringing it all together and understanding that when things are torn apart, how to then heal them is really urgently important. And I'll look into Bruce Lipton's stuff, so thanks, because I think that idea of when people don't know that the sun comes back up again, it can make a difference in a lot of people's lives. So
oh,
I really appreciate it.
Yeah, you're welcome. There's two books that they've authored so far. It's very humorous. Well, the one is Spontaneous Evolution. That was the most recent title. And then the previous one is also as good. It's kind of a precursor, more groundwork. It's called The Biology of Belief, The Biology of Belief. And the other one, the more recent one, is Spontaneous Evolution, which very quickly basically teaches that our DNA structure is loaded and embedded with vastly more potential than we have ever dreamed of, and we need to just come into a place within ourselves for that to activate, and then again, the game's over because, you know, we're so much more than what we've been programmed to believe.
Yeah, well, that's a great summary. Thank you. Tom, I hope you'll stay on the line. Dee or Kaya, do you want to jump in?
I wanted to thank Tom for being on the call and calling in and representing and being a voice for the veterans. One of the key things that I know that the president acknowledged and has made a declaration to meet the needs of the veterans, and that the lack of care needs to be addressed. The suicide rate amongst veterans has skyrocketed, and also the war and the Afghanistan war, many of the vets were redeployed. And they were put on these psychotropic medications when they started feeling, having, you know, just so much turmoil from repeated returns to the front, war front. There's just, it's distressing to know that the black warning labels, black labels, the warnings that come with these drugs are potential for an increase in suicidal ideation, aggressiveness. Those are the black warning labels. Dr. Bregan has written a book, and he's also spoken to several committees trying to address this profound concern and how it's impacting both the vets directly and the families when they come back. And they're going through, you know, the whole reacclimation to the civilian life, But also, many of these vets are experiencing these negative side effects of these drugs. Some of them come back and feel that they no longer need to take the drugs, but nobody's warned them about the withdrawal syndromes. And then the withdrawal syndromes get mistakenly identified as additional diagnoses, so it becomes a vicious cycle. The other thing that's occurring...
And it's such a scam.
Yeah, and I'm
sorry.
The other thing that's occurring that really distresses me is a lot of, and I've talked to doctors and I've talked to some of the psychiatrists, and they are admitting now that they have not been educated on the withdrawal symptoms and what to look for and how to be able to recognize a withdrawal symptom as distinctly separate from, you know, what they call mental illness symptoms. So, yeah, it's
great.
All a great big vicious cycle. Thank you, Tom, so much for calling in.
Yeah, let me just say one real quick thing about that. I was extremely empathetic of the suicide rates, and I was so emotionally charged with, I knew that exactly what our veterans needed, and I still feel like I do, and that is our experience, our identity needs to be expanded infinitely from a isolated blob of biological existence that ceases to exist when we do, which certainly puts us in a despair mode because we feel that we're worthless and meaningless in this black hole of existence, and we shift into an interdependent identity rather than a singular isolated identity. And then with that also, it's very important and proven, and that is that the most salient healing agent or the mechanism that supports and causes healing is empathy and kindness. Those two things, and if those are present, then that will deeply facilitate healing. And then finally, most important thing is for the healers and the helpers themselves to come into their own soulfulness, because we can't speak to what we aren't in touch with ourselves. And I'll stop there.
Yeah, no, I think that you're all very important points that you raise. I'd like to just inform anybody who may be listening about this article that came out today in the Associated Press by Jake Pearson, May 22nd, came out this morning at 7:55, and in it is included I'm just going to read the grisly, and I'm sorry, this is going to be very explicit and disturbing. The grisly deaths of two inmates, one who was, quote, baked to death in his overheated cell, another who sexually mutilated himself while locked up alone for 7 days, have raised new questions about the New York City's jail system's ability to deal with a burgeoning number of mentally ill people. This isn't my language. This is the Associated Press's language. But one of those deaths was a man that the AP reports. In the other case, Jerome Rideau, 56, a former Marine who suffered from bipolar disorder and schizophrenia, died in February after a heating system malfunctioned and caused the temperature in his cell to rise to 101 degrees. He was in a special unit for the mentally ill. He was taking psychiatric medications that experts say can make people more sensitive to heat. There's actually like severe death warnings out about certain psychotropic drugs and heat causing death. But the idea that what they're pushing is creating more hospitals based on this, and the idea that people are winding up being treated like this, locked 7 days in solitary confinement or in a cell that somebody doesn't realize that the heat has risen to 101 degrees. Why are we treating people like this, and people are dying at the hands of the way that they see us as less than human? And this man, Jerome McDowell, who was a former Marine, and so the immediate psychiatric assignment of people instead of looking at potential things like post-traumatic stress or other issues that somebody might have. I think what, I don't believe I'm going to be saying this, but I think what President George W. Bush is supporting right now of dropping the D from PTSD and to stop assigning some kind of psychiatric association to severe trauma should occur, and I think it should be extended to anybody who's experienced trauma, and that these are not diseases that are biological, and that we have to stop telling society that we have some kind of medical answer for something that isn't biological. Kaya, do you want to jump in?
I'm gonna jump in a few minutes, if that's okay.
Okay. We have
Lauren.
Oh, Tom.
Lauren, can I just say something real quick?
Yes.
Yes. Okay. So I'm new to this, and this is really heavy energy for me, and I acknowledge that all of this is true. And yet I want to protect my own energy system from being overwhelmed with toxic stories. I understand it needs to be shared. But that doesn't mean I have to watch the news and soak up all that energy. I would rather stay in a place of optimism and faith and work and not. And so I think I'm wanting to notice and respect that I have judgment, and yet I don't put that on you. I'm just sharing that I'm being impacted in a way that I'm asking myself, how do I want to navigate this sharing with you on the blog? Because for me, it's pure logic that if our society is in deep, deep darkness and ignorance, and worse, arrogant ignorance, then there's going to be tremendous suffering, and that's the state of the world. Although there's lots of helpers, too, that are growing and emerging. So it's a very mixed, very deeply entrenched suffering with lots of hope. And so it's a very difficult time and yet exciting time to be alive. I don't want to spend most of my time talking about how traumatized victims of our soulless systems traumatizes us, because that doesn't serve or feed me. So I'm in an inquiry. I'm asking for your recommendation on how I approach this. That's a tough spot for me. I really don't know. I don't know. I want to participate, but at the same time, I want to come away with a deep appreciation, as Dr. Bruce Lipton and the Unified Field Theory. That, you know, that ignites so much hope. Because really, to me, my own phrase is, identity is destiny. When we shift into our true, authentic, profound nature of our integral existence, then I am immediately healed of my sense of separation and fragmentation and torturous soul splitting. All that is just healed. You know, on a theoretical level, it's healed, and then the emotional and biology system has to catch up with that new context, but it happens with support. So I'm not sure how to come into this conversation. What do you suggest?
Well, I want to say that I hear you. I spend, unfortunately, most of my time in situations that are really disturbing, and I often ask myself, why do I continue to do this to myself? And so the emotional turmoil that that these human rights violations cause when we talk about them and when we try to expose them, I definitely experience. And I've struggled navigating my way around my emotions around these things, and you know, for better or worse, my rage usually leads me, and that's what gets me to, you know, do things. At the same time, I also have experienced this real sense of hope that can be, and that things can change, and that if you can put it somewhere in a theoretical level, that eventually everything else will fall into line. So I understand both sides of what you're talking about. And I do think that it's important that people have hope and that people can hear others who are making their way through not buying into the idea of what we're told by psychiatry. So if you want to talk some more about that and some of the experiences you've had or any others have had about this process, I'm all for that. But
okay.
At the same time, there are so few. There's like no independent media or voice for people who are psychiatric survivors. And so consistently for anybody who in the public who might be listening, who might not know about like these serious human rights violations that are being perpetrated, I feel mandated to talk about those kinds of things, even though
Got emotionally it's
very upsetting, you know. So, but if you'd
right.
like to talk about something more about strategies or any ideas that you have, I'm totally willing and looking forward to listening.
Okay, so you're giving me a green light for a few minutes?
Yeah, please.
It was, okay, great. I wanted to start then with the sacred, I call it sacred scripture, but it's wonderful poetry by Khalil Gibran. You recognize that name as he was the author of The Prophet. He's a Lebanese, mystic. Do you recognize that name, The Prophet? Khalil Gibran?
I'm not familiar.
Okay.
I am, yeah, for sure.
Okay. So it's just such an extraordinary, extraordinary, beautiful poetry. It's an allegory. But in there, he's about ready to leave on his ship. He'd been on this island with this wonderful community. And before he launches, his ship would come in. They asked him, would you speak to us? And they had all these different topics, including love and then pleasure and other things. So he responds to the question on pleasure, and he says that he would not rebuke the young people who sought pleasure, but what he would do is he said he would have them seek for seven sisters pleasure has, all of which are extraordinarily more beautiful and wonderful and so on than the one sister of pleasure. So the reason why I bring that up is because, this is my own intuition, is that we want to inform trauma-informed, expand that. So, and I've done this myself this whole last year. I've had massive hurricane level and volcanic eruptions of pure hate and resentment and just incredible negative emotions, that I had to get hospital support for that, not inpatient, but intensive outpatient. I was very happy, ecstatic with the service I got from the VA in Seattle and Portland Spawn. But anyway, so what I'm wanting to say is to come in to infuse hope with that trauma, so that we don't stay in a toxically shame-based or despair mode. And at the same time, this is all simultaneous and paradoxical, so we have to come into a not knowing space of allowing ourselves to be grander than we thought we were. And yet the most important thing for me in the healing process, especially when you're I would say the density of the darkness, which means a lack of knowledge, is so great that it just desperately needs to be embraced, which means what you're doing now. So you're creating a beautiful forum for us to come into this shared suffering and to give it credibility and validation and normalization, all those beautiful things that we desperately need. So I feel we're on the right track. And so we want to hold that grief and sadness and then allow it to expands. I had this thought come through. I wanted to check it out with you, that darkness is actually compressed light. That was my theoretical thought. But anyway, so if that's the theory, then the only antidote for suffering and for darkness is to embrace and infuse it with love. And that comes from within ourselves. If we keep on drilling down as if we're drilling down for oil, and we have to drill down thousands of feet for oil sometimes, or miles and miles, if we break through that gridlock and all those structures of oppression and indoctrination and everything, eventually we're going to come down into, as Campbell says so beautifully, into the center of our own existence. And if we combine that with a unified field theory in the integral, then we come into a place, a meadow, a beautiful vista and an epiphany and all the positive emotions that we're capable of. But if we've never been invited, it's never been catalyzed because it's never been recognized, never invoked, then someone, you know, that beautiful quote is it costs nothing for one candle to light another. So we're lighting those candles, but that has we recognize each other, infinity, the cosmology of us. Once we recognize and acknowledge that, then it ignites our true nature, which is elemental, which is completely interconnected with all of creation. And a lot of indigenous people truly believe, as the natives do, Native Americans, that all matter is infused with spirit. There's no exception. And we are that, so we are integrally beautiful and infused with spirit. So we come into that, the game's over. Okay, I'll stop there.
Wow. Kaya?
Hi. I'm so excited to have Tom on here because I get to listen to these amazing things that he says, and I've always wanted other people to get to hear them because I just think he has so much wisdom. So thank you, Tom, for being on. And I think that what he's saying is really important because a big part of shifting the medical paradigm and legal paradigm around suffering has to do with us waking up within ourselves. And I think that as we wake up and see that we're connected to each and every other person and every other living being in the world, that it will just be a natural thing that we wouldn't want to practice medicine in a way that's violent and in a way that hurts people. And I had this thought several years ago that, you know, might sound kind of woo-woo, but I'll just say it anyways, which is that poetry is actually the medicine of the future, and that any kind of medicine that actually heals us has to be poetic. So in other words, it has to encompass this idea that we're all connected and this feeling that we actually care about one another because we're so connected with one another. So I think that the model we have now in the mental health system, quote-unquote, of psychiatry is really the opposite. It's kind of like coming from the dark ages, basically. Like, it's coming from, like, the opposite of that sense of unity. It's coming from this idea that we're separate, we have to fear each other, that harming you will protect me, you know, this very dualistic kind of paradigm. So, anyways, I'm just really excited to get to hear Tom share with all of us about these ideas because, you know, we might say that they're woo-woo or they're new agey or whatever, but really, like, this is the reality. We are all connected, and the old system of quote-unquote medicine really isn't actually working, and I don't even really think it's medicine. You know, I don't think it's medicine if it's harming somebody. And I just wanted to say one other thing, which was coming up before about informed consent. I wrote this article a few months ago about why you can't get informed consent from a doctor and the question of what informed consent actually is. And, you know, a lot of times we say, well, you know, if it's informed consent, then it's okay. Like, we should all be able to take whatever type of medicine we want if we're choosing to out of our own volition. But I just, I posted the link to the article on the Blog Talk Radio page if you want to check it out. But basically, informed consent is a lot more complex than we think it is. You know, it actually requires that we understand the history of where the medicine came from, the politics involved, the economics involved, and that we understand all the other possible options of how we can look at our situation, as well as having accessibility to all these other options. So really, no one is receiving informed consent in our current medical system. And once again, going back to Tom's ideas, this sense of unity and connectedness with one another is necessary for us to value informed consent. And actually, informed consent even requires us to know that. You know, informed consent requires us to know that whatever we do to ourselves, we're doing to everyone else, and whatever everyone else is doing is affecting us. So, even though we might think of informed consent as just, I need to know if my drug is going to make me have diabetes or something like that, it's so much bigger than that, and I just wanted to bring up that topic
Thanks.
Thank you, Kaya, because I think that the issues of informed consent are crucial to where it is. And Tom, I really appreciate what you're talking about. And I think that these are the kinds of things that we need to be moving toward as a society and for people to hear them and not just brush them off as, whatever they would brush them off as. And so to be bringing that information up. Dee, you were talking before about your experiences. Were you, prior to, you had said something at some point about that you wish you had known of all of these things would happen. When you were prescribed the drugs, it wasn't with informed consent?
Again, that's such a up to interpretation. On none of the medications was I ever told that there's a potential for what we now know as withdrawal syndrome. I'd never even heard that term used before. I have not been on them for 4 years. I was on them for 3 years. I'm 59 years old, early childhood trauma. 9/11 happened, and I experienced profound trauma. In all of that, the only time that I had suicidal ideation on a profound level was after they had added a third or fourth psychotropic medication. And at that time, the only inpatient hospital, because I'd worked in mental health, I knew when that started happening, something was not right. So I self-admitted myself into the mental hospital I actually worked at because it was the only place within our region I could go. And when I self-admitted myself, the staff that knew me looked at me and they begged me, please don't do this. But I needed a safe place for 3 days where I could have time to think with no, you know, responsibilities. I just needed some time. I knew that my mind needed time and my spirit, my soul, that spiritual aspect of me. I needed some time to be able to get some kind of self-assessment and some perspective. And in those 3 days, it served me well with that regard. What did not serve me well was, I guess I was, when I went in, it's different when you go in and you're there for a couple of hours and you leave. But when you're there for 3 days straight, there was a breakdown in the regular programs they were supposed to have weren't occurring. It was that time that I actually got to witness somebody being pinned down and force drugged. From the inpatient point of view, I saw things from a worldview that I had never seen before. I saw what it was like to be not able to see a family member except during the two-hour visit, and I got to experience what that was like. And I got to experience the sterile, not-so-homey environment. So me with a lot of experience, I knew what was on the other side of that. But for somebody who has no experience in working in mental health, and that's their first experience, I hear story after story after story of how that was actually more traumatizing for them than the initial episode that got them into inpatient. The inpatient experience was more traumatic. So I have the thing I want to say two more things. So what I did is I didn't just stop taking the psychotropic medications. I titrated down. And the same time I was titrating down, I started really returning to my roots of practicing mysticism and yoga and meditation and essential oils. I have completely switched to essential oils, and I don't use any synthetic drugs in my life at all. An occasional ibuprofen because I have a back condition, but it's just
I'm so much happier. I'm so much more intact. I'm so much more in touch with my own, like I can regulate my own emotions. Whereas when I was on all those drugs, it was like walking in a perpetual cloud. You know, I couldn't really work through anything. It's like I was in suspended animation. It's really hard to explain. And that experience of being in a suspended animation was in its, that in itself is distressing. So I just wanted to speak to you, like, to give hope. It would be wonderful if, and I have no idea how we can flip this, but if we could flip it so that, you know, we can actually have things like, you know, the alternatives covered so that those things are more accessible. You know, a prescription, and I know some doctors actually have been able to write a prescription to a membership to the YMCA for people to help lose weight because that was a part of their overall well-being. But like that one researcher who discovered that the people that had been resistant to all the psychiatric treatment responded very well to exercise with a friend, you know, just all the and changing their diet. I mean, I can't remember how many people are being treated by a psychiatrist who are also matched with a nutritionalist.
Yeah, can I jump in for a second?
Yes, please.
I just want to say that in the state of Oregon, health insurance actually covers naturopathy. So I went to a naturopath for the very first time a couple weeks ago, and it was so amazing. I was like, wow, this person actually knows a lot. Like, I learned so much from this doctor just in one visit, and she gave me this whole, like, health plan and all this nutritional advice. And, you know, I didn't take all of it. I didn't do all of it, and, like, some of it was kind of...
Did she send the police to you?
What?
I said, did she send the police after you because you didn't take all of her advice?
No. Right, yeah. I mean, that's the funny thing is that, like, I have this fear of regular doctors now, too, where I feel like... But you know, I realized, actually, after my experiences in psychiatry, I then after was really scared to go to any regular doctor for a while. But when I finally did, I realized, you know, if it's not a mental health issue, doctors don't try to force you to do anything. So that was another kind of wake-up call, because I thought that I had this fear, like, you know, what if, you know, I have, like, something and a doctor tries to force me to take antibiotics and I don't want to. But I realized that, you know, if it's not a mental health issue, they never try to force you. So that's another major issue worth discussing. But I was just very excited that my health insurance actually covered this naturopath who actually gave me all this good information that actually has helped me, you know. I mean, I was able to shift my diet in ways that have already been beneficial. So
that's,
yeah,
awesome.
That's, like, that's just a little tiny taste of, like, what the possibilities are for what health insurance could cover and how much it could help us. You know, there are so many different types of practitioners that really have a lot to offer us to build our health and our wellness and just to actually, you know, be present with us. I mean, over the long term. But I think one of the issues, again, is that even with that naturopath who gave me this great nutritional advice, we didn't really talk at all about my life or who I am or what my goals are, what I'm excited about or what I'm upset about. You know, it was still a sort of a medical model, like, you know, do these things for your body and that will help, you know. And that's fine, you know, if you want to go to a doctor who specifically focuses on one thing, that's fine. And I think that that's important to some degree. But, you know, it would also be great if we had all different kinds of things or just – If doctors in general had that basic understanding that whatever is going on in our body is also connected to things in our emotions and in our spirits and just in our whole lives, really. Because I could follow all this advice and I could take all these supplements and eat perfectly, and if I am not, you know, addressing other things in my life, it won't really make that much of a difference. You know, like, there's always so many different pieces to our health that need to be considered. And, you know, I really think that health is so much more of a communal thing as well. You know, we have these health systems right now where we talk to one doctor or, you know, it's very isolated, and people become sort of self-absorbed in themselves and their own personal health problems and feel like they're so sick or whatever. But really, you know, so much about health does connect with everything in our world. You know, like, I'm so affected by everything around me, like by pollution and, you know, even just like the types of foods, the things in our foods or the things in everyone else's food that's making them the way they are, you know. So it's a big conversation, but I think we can start, you know, the idea of health insurance covering all these alternative, quote-unquote alternatives, is really exciting. And, you know, in Europe and a lot of other countries, it does. And, like, the first line of treatment is homeopathy and herbalism. And, you know, drugs aren't the first line of treatment, at least for physical health. So, you know, the U.S. is still kind of behind.
Right, and being pushed further behind by the lobbyists and the pharmaceutical industry and all of the money that's being made off of these things when you have something that's pennies versus, it already is pennies. It already is pennies, and so they just add the profit to it. But, you know, things that actually do help people heal and you know, thrive are very often not the things that can be funded. And so there isn't very much interest if there's no profit in it, I think. But I do think that people should be aware of all of these alternatives and ways that people are doing every day without, you know, psychiatry.
Yes, definitely. There are definitely so many alternatives.
I just thought of one other thing, too. I used to have a history of migraines, pretty frequent, on and off again throughout my life. And sort of one of the doctors was working with me and helped me identify food, things that I was eating that was triggering the migraine. And so we have a chart on the refrigerator, and so certain dyes that are used in food, certain preservatives, DHT, BHA, those are all the things that now I've completely eliminated from my diet, and so I don't get the kind of migraines that I used to have, and not near the frequency. I might get one a month, maybe, and when I used to get them almost on a weekly basis. So I sort of am looking at that and going, well, the migraines went away, but so did the depression, anxiety attacks went away, too, and I can't help but wonder, I wonder if maybe those were connected. But I don't think it's any one particular thing. I think it really is a holistic approach. I like the idea of the whole health centers that are being grown in certain regions in the United States. I also wanted to speak to, and I know this is a, you know, political hot button, but the CIT programs are being somewhat a better solution than what happened in that Formian recently. Again, it's...
I'm going to have to... I just want... Which programs?
CIT, Situation Intervention Team, Crisis Intervention Team.
It is definitely a hot topic.
It's a hot topic. And also crisis intervention clinics under the clinical model are starting to be grown.
Right. I think these are the kinds of things like what Kaya was talking about earlier around respite, you know, because really demedicalizing the entire process and the, unfortunately, I mean, in New York anyway, the crisis intervention teams usually are just a pipeline into the institutions or involuntary outpatient commitment programming. You know what I mean? They're not really interventions. But I think what you're bringing up, if I'm hearing right, is an important point. And I'm wondering if you've had any experience with respites or alternatives to those things, or if somebody might want to talk about what an alternative to even crisis intervention teams can be.
The state that I'm in, we don't have very many options. I don't think yet that we have a respite center in our entire state. and I could be misspoken.
Do you mind if I say something?
No, Tom, please.
This is Tom, okay. Daniel Fisher is the founder, or he's co-founder or host of a website, a national resource for mental health community and alternatives and so on. And it's called powertoyou.org, I think, P-O-W-E-R, number 2, and then, I don't know how to spell it, I think it's Y-O-U. But anyway, Daniel Fisher, he's a psychiatrist, and something else, but he's highly qualified. He had suffered from schizophrenia, and he was able to move himself through a very profound healing process, and so he has a global website now. But anyway, there's a lot of wonderful resources on there, and on those resources are several pilot projects throughout the country that do have, I forget what it's called, but it's basically an alternative subacute, which is a medical model term, I like to use that. But basically, they are respite homes. But I don't like to use the word respite because that's psychiatric also. But so basically, they're resting homes or recuperation homes they're peer run organization homes that help people stabilize from crisis to stabilization and on to their journey to thriving. So they do exist, and there certainly is a momentum movement. I would imagine it's even stronger in other countries, but the United States does have that there. It's just not government funded yet, and blah blah blah. But it's there. So
as it should not be. It seems every time the government gets involved, they misplace the original intention of what it was supposed to be doing. So yeah, thanks for that, Tom. Kaya, do you work specifically with alternatives like this?
I've never worked with a respite house. I guess the only types of organizations I've worked with have been privately funded, so like have been people who are paying out of pocket, paying a lot of money. So I've worked with Wentworth Associates in Northampton, Massachusetts, and the Alternative to Med Center, which was in San Francisco but is now in Sedona, Arizona. So both of the Alternative to Med Center is more of like a place that helps people withdraw from psychiatric drugs, and Windhorse does a variety of different things, but they're both pretty expensive and not affordable to most people. The Alternative to Med Center might be because they try to do things very quickly. But as for respites, I think the best model I've seen so far is the one in Western Massachusetts called AFIA. And I haven't even seen it. I haven't been there. But it seems that they do get government money for the Western Mass Recovery Learning Community. They get state money. But it seems that they've been allowed to do things. You know, they have a lot of really great people out there and really good visionaries, and it seems they've been able to do things in a very quote-unquote peer-run way, so they've really made their own decisions about how the respite will be run, and it doesn't seem like, the way I can see it, that the government has had much involvement. And then there are other models like Soteria. There's a Soteria in Alaska, the Soteria House. I think they get government funding as well, but also are pretty much able to use it in their own way. You know, it would be great if there was a lot more, because a lot of these respite houses, because of the lack of funding and the limited amount of space and limited amount of staff, can only really have people for, you know, a week or two, which is great, but, sometimes people need more than that. I think that what's great about Western Massachusetts is that there's a really great community out there, so people can go to the respite house and then maybe tap into the community and get more support, even if they can't stay there for, you know, more than a couple of weeks. I'm not sure, it's like 2 or 3 weeks, I think, that you can stay there. So I think that, you know, community is really the most important thing, but then it's also, you know, affordable housing and all these other issues that people
encounter that can make it harder to stay, to even connect with the community and feel like they will, on a basic level.
Right. So yeah, creating those opportunities is important. Kai, were you going to say something?
I was just kind of going to reiterate that economics are so much a big part of this, and, you know, making sure people just have basic resources. It's kind of like going back to common sense. Like, if someone's in a crisis, a lot of times they just need some basic things, like to eat, to sleep, make sure they have a home, a stable home where they feel safe, you know. And with a lot of those things, like, so many crises can be averted. I remember here in Portland last year, they have a center where they had some peer specialists, and it was new to be bringing these quote-unquote peers in as, you know, working with people in crisis, because it was a place where people went in crisis. And I think someone went there in crisis, and he was maybe suicidal or violent, I can't remember, but one of the peer workers sat down with him, talked to him, and gave him a sandwich. And I was just like, that's so beautiful, you know, like, this person just kind of needed to eat something, settle, and, like, have somebody listen to him. And then he ended up being fine, and the police didn't even need to get involved or be called or anything. So, you know, I think we need a lot of that in every state, like, to have people who've been through their own experiences be, like, the first line of defense or whatever we want to call it for somebody in a crisis, because there are certain common sense things that actually a lot of professionals get trained out of, you know, like, even therapists and psychiatrists get trained out of basic common sense. Like, sometimes somebody just needs to sleep, eat, and, like, have a place to relax and be listened to. You know, it's just so basic. And that's why I think the Soterian model worked so well, because they actually hired people who weren't trained professionals, who were just normal people who had a lot of empathy and understanding and common sense. And that's really, you know, the kind of people we need. And a lot of times, you know, medical school is so rigorous that people actually can, like, almost be stripped of their humanity just by going through it. Like, I think I heard someone talking about how psychiatrists go through so much in their residency. Like, they can't sleep. Like, you know, they're basically up all night studying for, like, years. And then it's like they come out of school with, like, a chip on their shoulder and kind of, like, pissed off, you know. So then it's like that gets transferred over to their plant.
It's true, and there is a, it's not called indoctrination for nothing, and so there is a stripping of humanity that I witnessed in a 10-year period of going through the doctoral program, that I you know, fought every day to keep in my front of my mind what I was doing there, instead of you know, falling under. And I was in environmental psychology. I mean, we weren't even anywhere near what, you know, clinical psychology would be doing or something like that. And so in environmental psychology. And so it is, the problems are rooted in the environment, and it's the environment that we need to fix, the social, cultural, political, economic, you know, discriminations of all types. And oppression and you know, the economic underlying factor, I think, is most urgent to have. And so what you were talking about, you know, a state paying for, you know, alternatives in health insurance, you know, these things unfortunately sometimes wind up costing money that people don't have, even though they're less expensive than pharmaceuticals and better for you. So how do you get, you know, the government to start acknowledging these evidence-based practices that aren't fueled by the monopoly of the industry, and to start having people want to take care of themselves and given the message that they can take care of themselves? In a blog that Jaffe wrote on Pete Early's website the other day, you know, he actually said, I don't know where he got the statistics from, but that 90% of the people will not ever be able to be employed, so programs that, you know, have training programs or anything like that are pointless, basically, is what he wrote. And that same idea around the messaging that's given to us about, you know, our less than human status, that we shouldn't have good nutrition, or we shouldn't, you know, and if you look at, like, what in an institution somebody is afforded, you know, for their nutrition, it's just absent. And so people are, you know, it's beat into our heads that we don't deserve somehow what, you know, every other human deserves, and it's easy to lose hope. And so I think, again, I want to thank you all, and Tom, I want to really also thank you for joining in tonight, Tom, because I think that people need this message of hope, and that they can get out of this, and that this isn't forever, and that, you know, someday that they will be able to look back and realize that it was as simple as hearing another message about what one was possible, you know, could potentially do with their lives.
Yes. May I put a real quick plug in for time banking? Time banking is an invention, has expanded to 30 countries, and people use the currency of time in addition to money, so it frees up tremendous human exchanges of services and things like that. So please look that up.
Okay, great. Dee, we have about 10 minutes left, so I just want to give each person a little bit of time to close out. Anything else you might want to mention, or things for a future show that we should be thinking about focusing on?
Well, I wanted to thank the people that are on the call, and I have heard a lot of the things that I heard on the call about respite centers, but hearing about it and not being able to actually go visit one has been a source of frustration for me. So what I'm doing this summer is I'm going on the road for most of the summer across the United States and Canada to visit places where people are bringing healing back into their communities.
That is very exciting.
As a way of being. So I'm going to really probably follow up, and it would be great if there's a way to get back in touch with the people on this call, you know, for who would be open to that. And just to let people know that I'm going to be continuing to work with you, Lauren, throughout the whole summer to provide updates on how that is going, because I'm going to visit some of these respite centers.
Absolutely, that would just be fabulous. And if you'd like to, like, make it a regular segment where you call in from the road and give updates and such, that would just be great. And I think that I've done the cross country thing a couple of times now in this way, and not focusing on that, but focusing on stopping force treatment. And I think it is one of the best experiences to ever have. And so, you know, anytime you want to come on and talk about what's going on, I think that'll be great. And I'm looking forward to learning a lot from what you're finding. And so thank you for your work. And I think that there's a lot of potential for things to happen, and that we have to keep on having these conversations about what's working, and let the public know that there are alternatives to what the traditional psychiatric systems are offering. Kaya, do you have any final thoughts?
Thanks, Lauren. I just wanted to say thanks to everyone, and I really appreciate your hosting. You did a great job. And I'm working on some e-books right now, so something I'm just focusing on in my own work is how to get things out there more, how to get things, you know, read more, how to make our own blogs go viral, and you know, sharing our stories and our perspectives so that we can shift the media to be more democratic. So I definitely am welcoming input on those areas, and I have a lot to share with others, so maybe I can come on your show again some other time. But I was also curious, just one question, is how often are you doing this show?
I think it will be just about every night from 9 to 11. Eastern, and I will be trying a couple of other times as time goes on, because I know some people are either on the West Coast or just getting in, or on the East Coast or just it's too late. So we're going to be trying out some other times, including the middle of the night, which I think will be an exceptionally interesting show as a middle of the night kind of person.
Thank you for your dedication to this, and maybe someday you'll teach me how to do the show, and I can try to do one on my own as well. Because I've been
absolutely
wanting to learn how to do it. Thank you.
Facebook me, it's real easy. And I think the more of these types of opportunities that are out there in the public, and the more we create our own independent media, the faster that we'll get to maybe getting a new consensus reality among the larger masses of society.
They
need to wake up because they're being fooled. And it's fraud that's being perpetrated on taxpayers, on individual massive human rights violations. And we need to keep talking about it and getting out to society and letting people know. Along those lines, I want to just remind people about three different events that are coming up. The Mind Freedom 2014 Creative Revolution Conference, Developing and Expanding Alternatives, will be in Connecticut from July 24th through July 27th. And you can get information about that at mindfreedom.org. And then on June 19th will be the 6th anniversary of Esmond Green's murder at Kings County Hospital Center Psychiatric Emergency Room. And we will be holding a demonstration and vigil in remembrance of Esmond Green and all others who have been murdered by psychiatry. And then July 13th at 6 p.m. through July 16th at 6 p.m. Will be the Mental Patients Liberation Alliance's, the Alliance's 34th annual Bastille Days vigil in front on the sidewalk in front of the New York State Office of Mental Health in Albany. And anybody who wants more information about any of those events can contact me. And there's a Facebook page, and if you Google the Alliance's 34th annual Bastille Day, it will take you right to it. There is also many opportunities for people to get involved and to speak out in your local places. It only takes a couple of people holding up signs to get attention. So if you have a couple of people that you know who are like-minded, go out, even just taking a picture of yourself holding a poster in front of a building and getting it out online and, you know, breaking the silence about psychiatric oppression, we must keep talking. I will be following up tomorrow about the situation of the murder of Michael Blair in Houston, Texas. And we'll be giving updates to that. And I know that the public information officer of the Fort Benton County Police Department will be on May 27th. So I will be giving up a follow-up call in relation to the death of Scott James at Nathan Klein Institute, Scott Jones at Nathan Klein Institute on the CREF unit. It is my understanding that it is being investigated, and I have additional concerns about that because there is also potentially Institutional Review Board human subjects protections that were violated because Nathan Klein Institute is a research institute, and so trying to find out what happened and what caused Scott Jones to die and why there was a mixed messaging about the cause of his death, either a blood clot or a seizure, depending on who you talked with, is definitely of interest. I will be on tomorrow night. We are going to be tomorrow Friday night from 9 p.m. to 11 p.m. We will be on air discussing the trans experience and personal stories of people who have had to fight their way through psychiatry. I want to thank all of the people who participated in the show tonight, Kaya, Dee, Tom, and all of the people who are listening. Thank you so much for participating. And please, if you have ideas for a show, you can leave it on the Talk with Tenny tip line at area code 718-273-8708. That's area code 718-273-8708. Until then, keep talking and talk to you later.